Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money, another gorgeous Monday in Park City, although we're in for changeable weather today. This is Larry Warren. Doug Wells is off today and sitting in Alex Butwinski, who comes in frequently when we have a vacancy. And welcome, Alex. Thanks for coming in this Monday.
Thanks, Larry.
And we're going to have some interesting weather, Alex, I think, today. We're in a different flow. And gone is all the fire danger, and now we're into a regime of rain and scattered thunderstorms, 40% chance. After the Rockport fire again, it's good to see.
It sure is. I think that monsoonal, is that how they describe
it? They call it a monsoonal flow, and I think of that as buckets of rain in the Far East, but it is a monsoonal flow even over a desert, and that means 40% chance of scattered thunderstorms today and tonight, and heavy rain, 60% chance expected tomorrow. So could be in for some stormy weather, chance of thunderstorms all week long. Well, to get to the topic at hand today on Mountain Money, we're going to talk about really one of Utah's foremost issues, I think, going forward, and that is the future of the Salt Lake Tribune. For over 100 years, it's billed itself as the independent voice of Utah, and it is in trouble these days with ownership issues, circulation issues, all sorts of issues like that. And we will be talking with Kara Porter, who is an attorney representing a group of concerned citizens who have sued the Tribune and the Deseret News, challenging the joint operating agreement for the Tribune. And we're having some telephone issues, but we will get to them as soon as we can. And who else do we have?
And then, Larry, we're going to speak with Mickey Grahams. She's the programs manager for Utah Microenterprise Fund. And they have been working in partnership with members of Utah's financial banking community to help launch or expand more than 760 small businesses across the state. Then we'll be followed in the studio by Lisa Schneider and Scott Loomis about Home Ownership 101.
And that is a program to get lower-income Summit County residents into homes that they not just rent as affordable housing, but can purchase. So we will talk about that, and we will be back with Mountain Money after this.
This is Ryan Hoffman, branch manager at Mountain West Bank.
And Brooks Harbertson, commercial lender, sponsor of Mountain Money on KPCW.
We offer several products and services for individuals and businesses, including deposit and loan solutions.
Mountain West Bank, Kearns Boulevard, next to the theater, 649-3369.
Division of Glacier Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Juniper Landing is proud to support our local radio station, KPCW. Juniper Landing is a new, whole ownership townhome community located at the base of Canyons Resort, adjacent to the Waldorf Astoria Park City, with a model open daily. Our website is juniperlandingparkcity.com.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. And we have on the line with us now Joan O'Brien, and we're going to be talking about the future of the Salt Lake Tribune with Joan, and hopefully we'll be joined by your attorney, Joan, as well. But welcome to Mountain Money.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, talk a little bit about yourself first. You're pretty much married to the Salt Lake Tribune, right? I remember your dad and also your husband.
Yeah, I call myself a legacy. I was born into it and worked there myself for almost 20 years, and my husband, Tom Harvey, is still a reporter there.
And you are part of a citizens group, the Utah Newspaper Project, which consists of readers and journalists concerned about the future of the Tribune, and you've gone to federal court to try to undo a new agreement between the Tribune and the Deseret News. And, of course, as readers, we have heard all about and read all about the declining fortunes of the Salt Lake Tribune, and there is a lot there. But let's just talk first about your lawsuit. What do you contend has happened, and what would you like to see undone?
Well, we are challenging under antitrust law the 2013 joint operating agreement. We allege that it violates the Newspaper Preservation Act, that, you know, which is itself a limited exemption to antitrust law. So this agreement, which was secretly entered into last October, realigns the revenue split of the two papers. It used to be 58% for the Tribune, 42% for the Deseret News, and now it's 70% for the Deseret News and 30% for the Tribune. That represents a 50% reduction in revenues for the Tribune. It also gives the Deseret News control over the operation, you know, the business operation of the two newspapers. That's Newspaper Agency Corporation. And, you know, there were some other transactions that took place as also as a result of this agreement, and it keeps in place a veto power that the Deseret News wanted so that it can, you know, basically, you know, determine who is the future owner of the Salt Lake Tribune should an ownership change take place.
And let's go back for those who may not know the whole history into the lineage of the Tribune. Of course, it has some Park City roots here in that it was purchased by a silver miner here who hit it big, Thomas Kearns, and he fashioned it as the counter to the Mormon Church and the Deseret News. And it remained in the Kearns and related McCarthy family for most of the last century, or all of the last century. And then when did things start breaking down in terms of family ownership?
Yeah, I would say that you could say things broke down in terms of family ownership and in terms of relationship between the Deseret News and the Tribune as well in around the year 2000. You know, the McCarthys had owned the paper since, you know, their family had owned the paper since 1901. And in the late 90s, the Tribune entered into a merger with the giant cable company, TCI. The Tribune happened to be an early investor in TCI and owned a great deal of stock that it needed to spin off. And so it entered into this merger to allow it to do that in a, you know, in a way that wouldn't involve huge tax consequences. And so the paper's ownership was interrupted there in the late 90s, and the Tribune's owners, the McCarthys, had an option agreement to buy the paper back, but while it was in the hands of TCI and then later in AT&T, the Tribune's original owners kind of lost control of the situation, and the Deseret News, through a series of maneuvers, basically brokered the sale of the paper to Dean Singleton, and his subsequent bankruptcy kind of landed the Tribune in the condition that it's in now, which is in the hands of a hedge fund, you know, based in New York.
Yeah. In any event, it's now well out of the hands of local ownership, and the current owners, a hedge fund, you don't believe have long-term interests in maintaining a separate voice for Utah?
Well, their pleadings, the defendant's pleadings, in our case, names as defendants the owners of the Salt Lake Tribune and the Deseret News. The defendant's pleadings basically say that the Tribune is up for sale. So, and it's widely believed that the entire hedge fund investment is, you know, on the auction block. That's been in the national press. The Tribune's lumped in with all these other newspaper properties, and this hedge fund kind of wants to get rid of them. So,
well, I don't know, Joan, that may be I think that's all in the rumor stage at this moment. But, you know, I'm curious as to, you know, one of the things that people have talked about is the, prior to all this, the shrinking of the Trib paper itself anyway. And I'm curious, do you think the layoffs would have happened? Is this a chicken and egg phenomenon?
Well, the paper is shrinking, you know, as you might imagine it would if its revenues had been cut in half. We believe that the mass layoffs that have taken place would not have occurred if not for this new joint operating agreement that cut the revenues in half. They've had to eliminate, the faith section. They've had to, you know, they don't have, they've had to eliminate the New York Times service, you know, which means, some people who really enjoyed Paul Krugman, they're not getting that anymore from the Salt Lake Tribune. You know, they've had to, you know, the Tribune doesn't have really a business section anymore because, you know, it puts out a money page, but doesn't have a single person, you know, editing or writing for that section now. So those are all things, that foretell what we call a downward spiral. The fear is that at some point, and you can't know exactly when it will occur, but at some point the paper will enter into a downward spiral. And that's a term that is applied to newspaper products, and once it's in one, they don't pull out. So, you know, that's the harm that we're fearing and are alleging will occur as a result of this new joint operating agreement.
Well, I was reading that John Payton is of Digital First believes that the digital futures in newspapers and something like Paul Krugman in the New York Times is available to readers of the New York Times. So wouldn't this have transpired anyway, that as you move towards digital, wouldn't this be expected to happen?
Well, you know, it is difficult to argue with the defendants in this case because, you know, they raise the digital argument, and of course everyone can see that we are in the middle of a digital revolution. That's, you know, you don't have to be, some digital guru or Harvard professor to see that. You know, the problem with them is I think that they've identified the wrong problem. The problem is with the subscriber advertiser model. The digital revolution is, disrupting that, but the product that the Tribune provides is news gathering, and the important thing is to preserve the mechanisms, you know, whatever they are, any revenue stream that pays for the news gathering, and let's just all agree that that's the product the Tribune is providing. And so for now, 80% of the Tribune's revenues come from print. And they've just cut that in half. And there's an elaborate business mechanism in place that's been there for 60 years under the joint operating agreement, newspaper agency corporation, that ensures that there's a revenue stream. And they've, they've disrupted that. You know, they're big devotees of the innovative disruption,
creative destruction.
Yes. Right.
Well, let's cut to the heart of the Tribune's problems lie in what your lawsuit is about, that the joint operating agreement between the two newspapers that let them share the back office and let them both survive, in a sense. The formula changed. The Tribune, because it had larger circulation, used to get 58% of the profits, the Deseret News 42%. Now this agreement has been renegotiated so that the Deseret News controls the board and they get 70% of the revenue and 30% goes to the Salt Lake Tribune. And the process and the amount of compensation is secret because it's an agreement between the two newspaper entities. But do you think, my reading of it is that the hedge fund must have just wanted cash up front and sold its future profits basically, to the Deseret News in switching the profit share so radically. Is that what happened, and will we ever know what happened because it was a negotiation between these two parties?
Yes, I believe that the Tribune's future was mortgaged by the hedge fund, and it was, you know, and it's been denied under this JOA the revenues it needs to provide its product, which is news gathering, currently and in the future, because it doesn't have, you know, it's being, you know, transitioned to the new digital reality, which, you know, we're still transitioning to. You know, nobody's got the answer to this conundrum that's facing all mainstream media. And I just wanted to finish a thought from before, which sure. is, you know, John Payton, who runs the Tribune from afar in New York, and Clark Gilbert, who runs the Deseret News now, you know, they recognize that the Internet does not provide revenues for news gathering, you know, that there's not any money in the Internet, and they refer to digital dimes replacing print dollars. Well, it's not even dimes, it's digital pennies. But at any rate, they recognize it's not paying any money. So their answer to that is to provide a product that isn't worth a lot. Okay, the Internet doesn't pay a lot, let's just provide a product that isn't worth a lot. So the Deseret News crowdsources a lot of its content. It, you know, it just reinvented itself a couple years ago and fired 85 people in one day. And, you know, Payton seems to have a similar vision for the Salt Lake Tribune. So so that's, you know, part of the problem here with this JOA. It's the fulfillment of that vision that, you know, the Internet doesn't pay a lot, so let's just provide a product that isn't worth a lot. And I don't think that's what the Tribune wants to do. And now back to the question that this is sort of like a private transaction somehow. It is not. This joint operating agreement was reached under the auspices of the Newspaper Preservation Act. It's an exemption to antitrust law. It, you know, the reason we got our hands on the JOA is because, you know, the Tribune reporter did what they do, and they asked the Justice Department politely for it, and they got it.
Well, John,
so,
I think...
So it's not a private, you know, transaction here.
Right. Well, I think that, as I read this, the money that was actually exchanged went to pay down some legacy costs that the Trib had. And as a result of that, so if you're collecting X and spending Y and Y changes, then it almost seems logical that the Trib should change the revenue share. In other words, if the pie changes and you get a bigger share of the pie because the net operating profit of that pie has gone up, I don't know
right.
what kind of pie that is, but anyway...
Right. Well, you know, the defendant's answers to our pleadings have been really vague about, you know, all of the terms of this joint operating agreement. And, you know, during discovery, we'll be able to get to the bottom of it. But John Payton, you know, that money that the Deseret News paid to the hedge fund, and speculation is it's $15 to $25 million, you know, that money went to the hedge fund. It didn't pay down any Tribune costs. It did include a renegotiation of the lease that the papers of the printing press that the papers shared. You know, because the hedge fund is selling off properties all over the country. You know, it's selling, you know, a building here and a printing press there. And
it has a lot of newspapers under its control, and clearly not a newspaper kind of business.
Right. They were, you know, they're kind of considered vulture capitalists, you know, so there are all these newspapers that are distressed that they bought and, you know, they're harvesting assets and then, you know, then they'll offer them for sale again.
You know, let me interrupt because here in Park City, of course, the Park Record is also owned by this hedge fund. Is there any... would you fear for its future as a freestanding, independent paper?
Well, I'm sure that it's, you know, I'm sure that it's going to be on the auction block, just like the Salt Lake Tribune. You know that, and it's not, you know, this is, you know, yeah, it hasn't been announced for sale, but you know, the national press have largely covered that the papers are being, you know, positioned for sale. So I imagine the Park Record will be in a, you know, on the auction block as well. But the difference between the Salt Lake Tribune and almost every other paper that the hedge fund owns is that it is in this joint operating agreement with another paper, and there are only a few of these left in the whole country. And that puts the Tribune in a whole different realm, you know, in terms of the law and in terms of its, you know, the deal that these guys entered into.
Let's set aside the whole talk about the joint operating agreement and just talk about Utah and journalism and the importance of the Salt Lake Tribune. I've said on the air for many weeks now, we have, thank goodness, we have a Salt Lake Tribune that still, even at its reduced staff levels, devoted the staff, the resources, the talent to keep the pressure on the investigators of the last two former attorneys general who were, ended up being indicted 2 weeks ago. What does Utah lose going forward if the fortunes continue in this downward spiral you describe for the paper?
Well, I think you know, I think that the damage will be extreme. I mean, every time a voice exits the market, I mean, the market is harmed overall. I think the market was harmed greatly when the Deseret News laid off 85 people and, you know, it launched its, what Clark Gilbert called the radical reinvention of the Deseret News. I mean, the marketplace of ideas is going to be greatly damaged. And the Salt Lake Tribune is just, you know, there's just no question that it's the most important news gathering operation in the state. It just, there's not another that devotes the, you know, the talent and the resources to news gathering as the Salt Lake Tribune does. And you look at it and you just, I mean, every day I shake my head and go, how are they doing this? You know, they just have such a depleted staff, but they're still putting it out.
Well, John, from the editorial perspective, what I've read is, you know, they want to keep that part of the business or the paper separate. And somewhere in what I read, there's reference to the five-member board, two of which will be Salt Lake Trib representatives, and that in order for something to change in terms of the joint operating agreement, they would have to be, the two of them would have to be unanimous in agreeing to that change. Doesn't that give you the safeguard you're looking for in terms of keeping the two papers separate?
Well, no. For one thing, the joint operating agreement, this 2013 document, has language in it that's never been seen before that contemplates the decline, the downward spiral of the Tribune. I mean, the section I think you're referring to is the reserved matters section. It requires just one vote of the Salt Lake Tribune members. And remember, one of the people representing the Salt Lake Tribune is this hedge fund. So it just requires, you know, the guys who entered into this disastrous agreement in the first place, just one of them has to agree to cut the circulation area of the Tribune, cut the number of days of the week that it prints, and cut and ceases to publish the Tribune. There's no corresponding language like that for the Deseret News, and nothing like that's ever been seen in a JOA before.
Yeah, the future of the Tribune is not unique. This newspapers, whether they're in owned by hedge funds or whoever, are just in their own downward spirals for any number of reasons, most of them the move to digital. Boston Globe, I think, that the New York Times paid $1 billion for, and they sold it for $50 million. And the Washington Post was sold only because a billionaire, Jeff Bezos, bought it. I mean, the Tribune is, this is not a unique situation at all, is there? I've heard the white knight possibly for the Salt Lake Tribune is our own local billionaire, John Huntsman Sr. Is there any future for the paper if it can be purchased by some entity that runs it as a nonprofit or someone like a billionaire Huntsman who buys it just to keep it alive? Is that really going to be the only future for newspapers?
Well, you know, I think that the condition of the newspaper industry is complicated. I mean, there are the local papers are not doing half bad, you know. And again, you know, we have to remember what the product is. The product is the news gathering, not the delivery mechanism. You know, we're pretty agnostic in our organization as to how the paper is delivered. If people are accessing it on their computer, then fine. The product is the news gathering, not necessarily the piece of paper that was delivered to your
door. Right.
We just argue that the print is paying for the news gathering for now. And when we get to a new business model, whatever it ends up being, you know, great. You know, whether it is the benevolent billionaire who creates a foundation, or there's some sort of crowdfunded mechanism, or there's, you know, a heaven forbid, a native advertising approach where the ads are sort of embedded in stories, that I would be distressed to see that. But, you know, there are all sorts of different models to pay for the news gathering floating around. Now, for as far as Mr. Huntsman buying the paper, that, you know, we don't take any position on who might own the paper. We just want to challenge this joint operating agreement that we that violates antitrust law. And you know, once the court makes the determination that it will take, then the paper will be sold to somebody, presumably.
So the outcome that you prefer would be what? And then I guess my next question would be, what happens if you prevail and that the joint operating agreement is unwound in some way? What would happen? What do you expect to happen?
Yes, that is the outcome we hope for. We hope that the court will find that a jury will find the 2013 joint operating agreement violates antitrust law and void it. And that would mean that the parties would revert to an agreement that they reached in 2011 that doesn't give the Deseret News control over the business operations, doesn't realign the profit split in the way that it does. And, you know, remember, the Tribune is still 60% of the two papers' circulation, so it's, you know, and giving it 30% of revenues is a little punitive. But, and then this 2011 agreement also provides for the Tribune's digital future. That agreement spun off both papers' digital operations, and the Tribune's been running its own digital operation since 2011. And so, you know, it would just go back to 2011.
Well, Joan, thanks for joining us. Sorry you had to carry the whole conversation. We couldn't get a hold of your attorney, but you did well explaining the situation from your perspective, and your lawsuit is proceeding in federal court. Of course, the Tribune and the Deseret News both pretty much arguing in court that it's none of your business. You're just a reader, and they are the businesses, and they will make the business decisions. So we'll see where that goes, and thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, and you know, we have a website, utahnewspaperproject.org, where there's lots of more information.
Okay, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Joan O'Brien from the Utah Newspaper Project, trying to unwind the agreement that she says is leading to the demise of the Salt Lake Tribune. Well, when we come back, we'll be talking about the Micro Enterprise Loan Fund. You need 500, you have a good idea, and you need just like 500 bucks or 1,000. This may be the solution for getting a small business launched. So we will be talking about that with Mickey Grames after this.
Hello, this is Kristen Egan of Park City Realty Group, and I support KPCW. Every day, I listen to and especially appreciate local news and weather. This has helped me live, play, and sell real estate in the Park City area for the past 14 years. I can be reached at 435-714-1067.
This is Christian Bohr with the Park City Chamber Bureau. Did you know that by shopping locally, you're supporting trail maintenance, our free bus system, and the many wonderful cultural and recreational opportunities in our community? When you shop or dine in Summit County, those dollars stay right here in Summit County. The Park City Chamber Bureau is pleased to support KPCW's locally grown radio show, Mountain Money. Remember, keep it local, keep it PC. The Park City Chamber Bureau is a nonprofit organization.
Hi, this is Stanton Jones from Silver Mountain Sports Club and Spa, a longtime supporter of KPCW. We offer over 80 fitness classes each week to our members, including spin, yoga, Pilates, aqua aerobics, Zumba, hip-hop hustle, and more. We have two locations in Park City, online at silvermountainsportsclub.com. Be stronger, live healthy, play longer.
And we're back with Mickey Grahams from the Utah Microenterprise Fund. Mickey, could you tell us a little bit about your role and how the fund works?
All right, be happy to, and thank you for having us this morning. I'm actually the programs manager for the fund, but really what my job is to work with our applicants from the time they enter the program all the way through closing of their loan, and to give them basically one-on-one consulting to improve their business plans, make sure things say what they need to say, and also give them a little consulting when needed on particular aspects of their business. For example, we work a lot with our clients, helping them understand cash flow forecasting.
And, you know, this idea, I first saw it, I think, on a 60 Minutes story about, Muhammad Yunus.
That's correct.
In India, and he was giving out, you know, $5 loans and $10 loans to mostly to women. And so that they could buy some sewing supplies or buy whatever it is they were good at making that they could sell. And this is, and he wound up winning the Nobel Peace Prize for his work with microenterprise. So the scale is a little bigger here, but the idea is still people have good ideas and maybe not just the few thousand dollars it would take to test out the idea and see if it worked. So what are the range of your loans, and what sorts of businesses have you funded in the past?
Well, as far as the loan dollar amounts are concerned, obviously what Muhammad Yunus did doesn't work too well in the United States.
$5
doesn't take us very long
to talk
exactly
about your business.
We lend up to $25,000. Our minimum loan amount actually is $1,000, but never really had anyone ask for that amount of money. But we do a lot of loans in the range of $5,000 to $15,000. But just to give you an idea with the number of applicants we've had in the last 4 years, we've actually lent close to $5 million. So what we're doing is providing a financial resource for individuals, small businesses, who cannot currently access traditional or bank financing. For example, our program is designed for new businesses. Very difficult for many new businesses to get a bank to finance them. A lot of our businesses don't have enough collateral as a new business or even as an existing business. And some of our businesses, our owners have had some credit issues. With the recession that we went through, homes lost, foreclosures, that sort of thing, that's affected their credit. You know, at the Microloan Fund, we love to say that bad things happen to good people. And so we try to work with people who have had credit issues, and we can still do loans in spite of a low credit score. We don't have any restrictions on the type of industry or business that we can do. You can pretty much name the industry, and we've probably done a loan to them. Everything from the little individual who has started a yard maintenance or snow removal business.
Needed to buy some lawnmowers and snowblowers.
Yep. Okay. All the way up to, we've actually assisted during the recession, we assisted several manufacturers who had their credit lines pulled by the bank, and by giving them a $25,000 loan, it enabled them to adjust their inventory and stay in business during the downturn of our economy. So we've done them all.
Well, that sounds exciting. What was the source, or what is the source of the money that you are able to lend out? Obviously, money is coming back to you, but you had to have some startup capital. So how did you put that together?
Well, as a private nonprofit, which is what we are eligible for what's called CRA dollars from our banking partners, CRA being Community Reinvestment Act dollars. They're required by law to contribute money to promote economic development within their communities. So just about every major bank is a contributor of ours, and we greatly appreciate appreciate that. We also partner with organizations like Salt Lake City and Salt Lake County through their revolving loan funds. And probably one of the most rewarding programs is we partner with people with disabilities. We have a special program through their organization where we can help individuals who have a disability start a business at a very low interest rate. And happily, 2 years ago, I was given permission to also use that particular program in conjunction with Utah's Wounded Warriors. So they contribute most of the funds if we are lending under that program. We also are eligible for a national grant through the U.S. Department of Treasury. They do put out grants for microlenders as well, and we've gotten those grants over the past several years.
So your fund is actually guaranteeing or looking at the collateral for the loan in order for it to be paid back if the people are unable to do so or their idea is not as successful as they would hope?
Well, it's not necessarily a guarantee. What it is that we do maintain a loan loss reserve in order to cover loss of funds. But some of our partners, for example, Utah Assistive Technology Foundation, they're the people with disability folks, they will actually absorb some of the losses as well.
And the good news and the reason we had you in today is this has been a Wasatch Front pretty much organization, but now you have the funding and staffing and desire to move to the Wasatch back.
We certainly do. We have been basically from Utah County north to the Idaho border, but we have the ability to come both into Summit County and Wasatch counties. The funding is there. There's no, again, restrictions on the type of industries that we can lend to. We're interested in assisting the small businesses in this area either get a start in business or advance their business with funding up to $25,000.
So how can our listeners take advantage of the program? What do they need to do?
Well, first of all, they might want to take a look at our website, which is umlf.com. That's Utah Microloan Fund, umlf.com. Give you a good explanation of our program and also give you an idea of who all of our current borrowers are. Then, if they're interested in applying, they can come to an orientation meeting. I hold those meetings once a week at our offices in Salt Lake. During the meeting, I go through the program. Here's how it works. Here's how you qualify. They also receive their application materials at that time. And that's once they're in the program, then they start getting that one-on-one assistance. Because I happen to live out here in Summit County, whenever I have applicants up here, I try to spend a lot of time working with them either on the way in or on the way home to save them that trip into Salt Lake City.
And it has to be for you a business. You're taking a hard-headed look at business plans, just mm-hmm. like any banker would. You are the banker, and you're interested in microenterprise, but you still have to have some discipline and expect that of your those you lend to, right? I mean, you can't just come in with a crazy idea.
Well, that's correct. The approval process, a little bit different, is based, first of all, on the validity of the business plan. Does it make sense? Is it an idea? Has the applicant thoroughly researched it? We also look closely at their cash flow projections. Now, again, remember, they're going to get one-on-one assistance putting this information together. But does the cash flow make sense? Are they conservative? Do they realize businesses tend to start out slowly? But interesting enough, the biggest part of our approval process is based on the character of the individual. Our applicants are going to actually meet with the credit committee in a 30-minute appointment. Now, as I joke in orientation, we know they're all characters, but of course not what we're talking about. The committee gets the opportunity just to chat with them, ask them questions. They're just looking for that strong indication that this is the kind of person that's going to work hard and they're going to work to pay us back.
So what kind of default rate is it? Do you experience? Is it comparable to commercial banking, or are you willing to take more risk?
We do absolutely take more risk, but interesting enough, during the recession, our default rate was kind of envious of the banks were envious of us, I should say. We're generally less than 12%, and when you consider that our loans are considered high-risk loans, that's really quite low. We have a good program in that we don't use collection agencies. We have a woman in the office that works with our applicants on payment plans, so if they're struggling, if they've got a period of low cash flow. Because we're a nonprofit, we can work with those, reduce their loan payments, help them through that difficult time. We never want an applicant to go out of business because of our loan payment.
So, Mickey, actually, thank you very much for coming in and sharing with us the way in which the Utah Microenterprise Fund works and really the exciting news that you're expanding to Summit and Wasatch counties. So we'll be back after these.
We'll be back to talk about home ownership for lower income residents of Summit and Wasatch counties after this.
Hi, this is Bob Dillon, a lawyer in the Park City office of Jones Waldo with 38 years of legal experience in complex real estate transactions. Proud supporters of KPCW, Jones Waldo provides local businesses with legal services in areas ranging from real estate to employment law. Our website is joneswaldo.com.
Wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report every weekday at 6:50 and 7:50 during the morning news with Leslie Thatcher. Sponsored in part by Cushman & Wakefield Commerce Commercial Real Estate and Park City Mountain Resort.
Welcome back to Mountain Money, and our final guests in the studio, no strangers, Lisa Schneider and Scott Loomis. Lisa with Habitat for Humanity, Scott with Mountainlands Community Housing Trust, and you've been on previously to talk about Home Ownership 101, so we will get to that in a few minutes, but first of all, welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks. Good morning.
Now, is the landscape changing? This is your upcoming presentation, Home Ownership 101, obviously aimed at getting more people purchasing. And do I understand that it's maybe getting a little easier again for lower incomes in Park City to be purchasing?
No.
No.
I don't know if it's easier to purchase, but the market's definitely picked up.
I guess that's what I mean. Is there more product out there, and is there more opportunity out there?
Well, I think more than anything, there's more interest out there. We went through the recession, which kind of some of the programs we have, we were getting four or five people interested in our mutual self-help program, for example. Now we've got a group of 10 going, and we're starting another group of 7. So that's picked up considerably. People are interested in buying homes. We have a lot of approvals that have been sort of in the pipeline for the last 2 or 3 years that haven't come to fruition yet, but are getting closer. So I think we haven't done the Homeownership 101 program for about 5 years. I think the last one was 2009. So it's time, and there's some product coming. Again, a lot of interest. So we think it's a good opportunity for people who are interested in homeownership to start doing their homework, finding out what they need to do to get qualified, and also to see what's available.
And Lisa, that's the point of this seminar.
It is the point, and it is a collaborative effort between Mountain Lands, the Board of Realtors, Habitat, and Park City. And the idea here is, you don't just wake up one day and say, I'm going to go buy a house. It takes a little thought. You have to think about, well, where am I going to live, and how much do I need to save? And if I'm a moderate earner, are there programs out there that could help me get into homeownership? And what do I need to do to prepare? Is my credit in good shape? All of these kinds of things that we want to be prepared for. And it might take 2 or 3 years for somebody to really get ready. And that's a great window. As Scott mentioned, we have some approvals that are pending and things coming online, and we'd like people to be ready for those opportunities.
Yeah, it seems to me the challenge must be defining affordable housing and middle-income housing. I know that's something that the city has talked often about. And is that a problem you find just in the county, or do you deal much in the city with that issue? I mean, the definition of it is somewhat, I know there's a formula for affordable, but it seems to me you'd have to be doing quite well to be able to afford a home.
Affordable, yeah, it doesn't seem so affordable to an awful lot of people.
That word covers a lot of ground when you start drilling into the numbers. And from Habitat's perspective, we're looking at families who are earning between 30 and 60% of the area median income. And so we know that in Summit County, the area median income is about roughly $100,000. So that's our window of affordability. Mountain Lands goes a little bit higher, I believe.
Yeah, and it depends on the programs. There are a wide variety of programs available for very low-income people earning under 50% of the median income for low-income. And I think what we're going to see in the future is some programs that are available for kind of that moderate income, and that's some of the development that is coming forward.
So is moderate a defined formula as well? Or?
Well, actually, technically, by HUD's definition and various things, the state of Utah has an affordable housing requirement for, and that's usually 80% of median income and below, which is family of four earning for $80,000, roughly. A lot of the deed restrictions, if a unit doesn't sell within a certain period of time, it might jump up to 120 or 150, or sometimes the income limits go off. So there is product out there for almost everybody. And I think even with Park City Heights and Silver Creek Village, eventually there's going to be unrestricted market rate units that are more in that $400,000-$600,000 range. So there's some product coming.
And that means that people will be able to then sell, if they buy at market rate, they'll be able to take advantage of any appreciation, if there is any, as opposed to being deed restricted in terms of what they, I wouldn't call it profit, because barely, I think the restriction that I've heard would barely keep up with inflation.
Well, it's 3%, which people used to complain about 7 or 8 years ago.
Nowadays, that's not a bad rate of return if you look at what's happening with your bank account.
Yeah, and we used to get that back when there was very high appreciation, 20% a year and that type of thing, where people were complaining about their neighbors being able to sell, and here they were in this deed-restricted home. But now people look at it, I think, as a reasonable return. And that's not a guarantee. It's
right.
If somebody's willing to pay that for it.
I think that's a really great question along the lines of, if you had the opportunity to get into a deed-restricted home for, in Habitat's case, our mortgages are roughly around $700 a month, maybe a little more depending on location. But if there's a deed restriction on it, you're still getting, what is it? Fair market rent here is over $1,200 for a two-bedroom apartment. So take the difference and invest it, or put it into your child's college savings, or there's a lot of ways you can slice that pie and consider how you're going to invest the dollars.
Right. And you mentioned Silver Creek Village and Park City Heights. Dirt is moving on that project, and there is much in the pipeline. Is there always going to be an affordable housing shortage in Summit and Wasatch counties, or do we have a handle on that whole issue that we've had for two decades?
Well, 5 or 6 years ago, both Park City Municipal Corporation and Summit County passed what they call inclusionary zoning ordinances. All new developments in the county have to have 20% affordable housing, and that includes commercial. In Park City, it's 15%, and there's obviously, Park City is pretty well built out, but I think we're going to have some opportunities that didn't exist before, because it's going to be on site. In the past, there was in lieu fees that were paid, and what do you do when you don't have land? So I think there's going to be opportunities that didn't exist moving forward.
Just in hard numbers, I think we're looking at over about 675 units over the next decade plus.
And that's what's been approved already, and that means rentals, condos, townhouses, single family, a little bit of everything.
And does that mean that the labor force here can pretty much entirely live here, or are there still going to be those who are spending a significant amount of their dollars commuting in from distance like the Wasatch Front?
Well, theoretically, this mitigates the growth It doesn't resolve the problem that we have right now for the existing people that are here. So as we grow, there'll be more opportunities for the workforce to live here in the community, but it really is never going to make up the shortage that we have right now.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about Home Ownership 101. Where are you going to do that? When and what are you going to cover?
We're going to be at the Board of Realtors office over on Prospector. In Prospector on Wednesday at 6 o'clock, 6 to 8, and we'll be covering a number of topics. How do you partner with a real estate professional and a mortgage professional? How do you navigate that and know who to hire? Who should represent you? And you'll have a chance to know what your rights are as a buyer, what the fair housing rules are. You'll learn about the different contracts that are involved in a real estate purchase, and you'll get to learn about the various affordable housing programs here in Summit and Wasatch through Mountain Lands and Habitat for Humanity or otherwise maybe through the developers. And we are providing pizza, and so you can come after work and have a bite to eat. There'll be some door prizes to incentivize people to come and learn about what the options are.
And actually, it requires a RSVP too, because there's limited space. And I'm as of the middle of last week, it was about half full. So you need to call the Board of Realtors office, which is 200-6900, and ask to be put on the Homeownership 101 list. And we, I think, expect a full house.
And your website would also have more details?
Housinghelp.org.
Or habitat-utah.org.
Okay, very fine. Well, thanks for joining us, Lisa Schneider with Habitat and Scott Loomis with Mountain Lands Housing. And we will be back to wrap up Mountain Money after this.
Each week on This Green Earth, we bring you interviews with experts on environmental topics from local to global.
We've brought you award-winning authors Richard Louvre, Alan Weissman, and Terry Tempest Williams.
Politicians like Robert Reich and Ralph Becker.
And scientists like Michael Mann and Paul Ehrlich.
That's This Green Earth, Tuesdays at 9 a.m. on KPCW.
Brought to you by Republic Services, Vail Resorts,
and Rocky Mountain Power.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery, we know what grows, ParkCityNursery.com. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
And welcome back to the closing minutes of Mountain Money. We talked first with Joan O'Brien, did not get her attorney on the phone, but Joan did a nice explanation of what is at stake from her point of view. I can't imagine, Alex, a future without a Salt Lake Tribune giving us a look at what's happening in Utah.
I agree, Larry. You know, I'm a regular reader. I find their editorials a good counterpoint to what's going on in the state generally, and they do have a very, again, objective viewpoint from a reader, so perhaps there's a little bias on my part.
And just the institutional knowledge of reporters like Paul Raleigh, who've been there for 40 years. I mean, that's just irreplaceable.
That certainly is. That it'll be missed. I think what Joan had to explain to us was certainly interesting. It was from the citizen viewpoint of the group that's trying to save the Trib. And I, for one, am curious to see how that works out.
And let's hope there is a future for independent journalism everywhere in America. Their website is utahnewspaperproject.org. If you're interested in the microenterprise loan program, that website is UMLF for UtahMicroLoanFund.com. And go to housinghelp.org to find out more about Home Ownership 101. I want to thank our guests today, Joan O'Brien, Mickey Grames, Lisa Schneider, and Scott Loomis. And also want to thank our great sponsors, the Park City Realty Group, Mountain West Bank, the Iron Mountain Group, the Park City Chamber, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties, San Francisco Design, and Jones Waldo, Holbrook, and McDonough. We thank all of you for funding public affairs programming on KPCW. To brag for a second, Alex, next month we are up for Station Non-Commercial Station of the Year, the Marconi Award from the National Broadcast Industry. So, getting
justifiably so, Larry. I think that's going to help everybody's morale. Not that it's bad, but it'll certainly be good. And every time you talk about it, you're smiling.
Well,
and I think that's good.
You know, getting a little recognition from the National Broadcast Industry for what we do in this little station is great fun. So, always great to have you here, Alex, today. And time for NPR News. This is KPCW Park City.